You shook your head a moment ago. What were you going to say?
Oh, I was just thinking that I really feel that until you can love another person, and the kind of love which is involving yourself, that you can't love God. Because you'll end up with the same kind of selfish love. If God is a thing, like another person becomes a thing.
How about that sequence? Do we first learn how to love ourselves, and then we learn to love others, and then we learn to love God? That's the way Ambrose does it.
I don't ever remember learning that.
Doris first.
Ed, you have something. I think impossible to love somebody else unless we love ourselves and have a self-respect and self-regard.
Mm-hmm. Anne, did you have a word?
No, exactly. I'm listening now.
Okay.
Cool. I said something about learning to love. I don't remember ever learning to love. But...
Good.
Never took love one and two at school.
Yeah.
Well, does that mean that we don't have to work at it? There's the very beautiful passage, the picture of the garden. It is no disparagement to a garden to say that it will not fence and weed itself, nor prune its own fruit trees, nor roll and cut its own lawns. A garden is a good thing, but that is not the sort of goodness it has. It will remain a garden as distinct from a wilderness only if someone does all these things to it. Its real glory is of a quite different kind. The very fact that it needs constant weeding and pruning bears witness to that glory. And then that it is by that the splendor of the garden, to liberate that splendor, to let it become fully what it is trying to be, to have tall trees instead of scrubby tangles and sweet apples instead of crabs, is part of our purpose.
I think you could maybe have to learn how to love, but you could never learn how to fall in love. It's like the jump of faith. I mean, I don't know about the psychology, you have to love yourself in order to love. I think you're in order to probably fall in love to come that jump that you really love someone. But I think through the years, you can use your head and heart combined and work at maintaining or increasing love. But I don't think I'm with him that you can't learn how to fall in love, how to love.
Maybe you can have the equivalent of Spinoza's, the intellectual love of God.
How do you do that?
I don't know, he just wrote that.
It's about time I fell in love. Getting on a bit. Had to better do something about it. And to that, the word of Betsy's wisdom. It happens. Trying to make it happen is likely to inhibit it's truly happening. But on the other hand, having there also the stance of faith, the openness of being given to, and recognizing, there it is.
A while ago you said God is not impassible, and I don't get that. I don't know what you're... what that means.
Well, that was way back on Monday morning when we were just sort of rambling toward this discussion. and the question of God. Some theologians, the scholastic theologians particularly, and those the earliest ones who asserted this were those who were philosophically conditioned, asserting that God is perfect, he can suffer no want or lack, he certainly cannot suffer pain. To think of God that way is to be thinking of God in a way that we do not find God to be when he hangs humanly dead on the cross. There's a great Japanese theologian has written a book, Kitagawa, on the pain of God, how his heart turns within him and is wrenched with his love for his people in Isaiah, these passages. Now, do we begin there to learn what love is like, or do we begin at the point of learning to love ourselves, then love others, and then finally move to loving God? Or what of the progression of this book, which has been from the lower to the higher? Is that the right way of getting at it?
I have to be open first off to their loving, and then sometimes I love. I mean, there's commitments that run pretty constant, but there's no love at that. And when you're talking about learning to love, I think love is initially just that kind of a response, and maybe I'll learn, some kind of a deep part of commitment. But when you're talking about permanence being sort of a factor in measuring love,
it's like trying to get it in a box and lock it tight and not letting it have that ongoing sort of flowing what more it may be kind of life, or the not overloading it that we spoke of, letting each love be the size of love that it can be, and not diminishing or inflating that, and not placing prescriptive insistences upon it. But what about when love dies in a marriage? What do we mean when we say such a thing? And you pointed to that with the other things that may become a part of, grow on from the eros kind of love.
Doesn't Lewis suggest that if love dies within the marriage, that people aren't really loving the other person, they're loving love. They've made love their object, and you can't do that.
Right. Which this, and this, whatever it is that they are calling love at that point, they are allowing to be larger for them than the other person.
What do you mean? It seems like they would, at the point they begin to love, they would begin to define what that love is supposed to be. And again, demand things that maybe are or can't be within the relationship.
Right.
And so
good.
Is that what you mean by love being larger?
And what you say about demand, as if then you might have a checklist. If there's going to be love in our marriage, then we can tell that by these 20 points. And we tick them off and find that there are only 5 left. Better we quit. And to call that love is a very strange usage of the word, where it is equivalent to a list of demands that the other person is there to fulfill for me. One of the great criteria that we've bumped into is whenever we find ourselves getting to be self-regarding, then we know that love is dying.
I've always been bothered by this verse, "Thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself." Mm-hmm. And what's bothered me about that is because I don't know, I've always thought it was wrong, but I didn't know what loving myself meant. Because I was taught to love others. God is love, and God is in everybody, and so you love others. And it has been a little bit hard for me to get this idea that I didn't love myself enough, I didn't have a self-image. I had never thought about my self-image. And I'm wondering if there's something happening wrong about
it. And there's a whole world of current opinion that would push you to feel bad about your self-image. To hell with your self-image. Christian doesn't live inside himself. He lives in Christ by faith and his neighbor by love. We know by nature what it is to love ourselves. That's the way we come into the world.
I suppose it means taking care of yourself.
Yes, and how we do it, right from the beginning, the baby lives a very self-centered existence. Everything else exists to respond to baby's needs. And as we grow, we take very good care of getting the things we want, that kind of solicitude for ourselves and our own good, that is displaced by the love of God, and then that love becomes available for our loving others, since we don't have to love ourselves anymore. God does such a splendid job of that already. If you take the picture of a bucket, by nature we are just brimful with self-love. Into that bucket comes the love of God and pushes out all of that self-love, that care about someone's good, that then can overflow the bucket and be the love with which we love ourselves is then there for our neighbor.
Don't we learn God's love through others who love us? And we learn God's love through paternal and maternal love. And we feed on that, which is parental love, but also God love through those around us. And a child's self-image is developed because of the image that others around him give him of himself. Because as others see him, they reflect that image to him. And if he catches loving images, then he becomes a loving person. But if he catches hateful images, he can become a hateful person.
We are by nature incapable of love. By nature, we care only about ourselves. That is our condition, original sin, and all that. Love has to be loved into us. The initiative of love we are incapable of. And we love him because he first loved us. And the bother with trying to start anywhere else than God's love is that we would presuppose that it's possible to generate love anywhere else. Or out of ourselves, this getting to love ourselves first, and then getting to love others, and then getting to love God. The only where love comes from is from God, and that's where the initiative lies, and it is in being loved that love is loved into us, and we then are shaped, quickened by that love, and love is a living thing. The relationship between life and love is a living thing that cannot but flow out. And what you say ties in with the fourth commandment, where we are bidden to honor our parents. Honor, the word there is something that belongs to God. And yet we are bidden to thus honor our parents, for they are his replacement for us. And parents have God's job to do for their children. And so what they learn of what God is like is what their parents are for them. They are his deputies. He has done an interchange. And, well, you could tell more movingly than I am sure what it means when a child is not loved, when parents do not know themselves to be God's deputies in the creation of life in the first place, that God shares creating life with man and woman, and that life entrusted to them. You take care of it for me, says Father Creator God. And it is there that a child learns what love is like. And then when we tell children that God loves them, those words have meaning because of what their parents have done in doing the God job in loving and caring for their children. Similarly, as Lewis says about the glories, he wouldn't really, what he learns from the world with the content of words like splendor and beauty and joy, we have that experience, and those words have content, and then we have some inkling of what we are talking about when we use those words of God. There was a hand back here, further back. Yes, mm-hmm. Yes, please.
You said if the parents don't know God or don't know how to love, isn't it beautiful though that we go back to affection and mother love that is built into them, so that naturally a mother will do what is right?
Right. Yes. That is the beneficence of the first article of the Creed. That all of that good is there from God's creating hand. And so there are splendors of love that Lewis talks about as sort of the pagan sacraments. But he also points to those loves going wrong or falling short of fulfillment unless they are all redeemed. Well, that's my way of putting it, that I suggested yesterday, the movement to the second article. And that we don't have a progression within created resources, the things under the first article which can bring us to the love of God, that sort of lower to the higher with under the article of creation. For we live in a fallen creation, and we are gone wrong in our sin, our denial of life, our denial of love, and we need to be brought alive to that. And the full life and vitality of all of that is when our loves are redeemed. And that's all the gift of the second article of Christ and his becoming a part of all of our createdness and living it through with us. And then the redemption of it all, so that the resources for our loves, that love which enfolds and energizes all our loves, is not a love we can read off from the evidences of creation, but that is ours at Calvary. I thought there was a further hand. Carol, you had.
I was sort of back on this business of learning, being loved, and then responding. Maybe that related to both of those. I was wondering if there was a corollary between this increasing capacity as we're loved, we're able to love, and Jesus' remarks, to whom much is. The business about being forgiven much, then maybe you're able to forgive too. And if something goes wrong with that, I was going to try and look at that a little bit. I'm not quite sure what goes wrong. Is it a turning inward or something that it stops the flow, and instead of increasing, it becomes self-centered. I'm just trying to think of that. I don't have the whole thing thought out.
Marriages break when there is a refusal to forgive. It is only those things which are held outside of forgiveness which can destroy a marriage. And there we are in the second article, redeemed. And not just in the first article of making a sort of adding up the score of what things are in the spouse or not in the spouse, and does that add up to enough? It is only those things which are held outside of forgiveness that can destroy a marriage. But that And nothing can destroy a marriage when everything there is within forgiveness. And that forgiveness operates as that marriage lives within the forgiveness of Christ. From him the resources to forgive one another.
But how about wife abuse? Is she to forgive and forgive and forgive?
There are pathological cases where the continuance of a marriage relationship is rendered impossible. But one should not state that as a rule, but in each particular case struggle through. Each one is a unique one, and there's no rule of thumb about any of that.
Well, I just think that there is a point where
one recognizes that.
It breaks up not because one is unable to forgive.
The one person may go insane.
Well,
but there are those who have also maintained their fidelity even through that.
But less than insanity. I mean, emotionally, a person can become so brutal, emotionally disturbed, that they're not insane, but at the same time, they render a marriage impossible to continue.
Mm-hmm.
But even if you can't continue the marriage relationship, doesn't mean that you don't have to forgive it, you know.
Yeah, but you have to get out of the situation.
Yeah, but you also have to forgive.
Well, yes, you can forgive after you've gotten out of the situation. Well, you can forgive and forgive and forgive, but there's a point where you have to remove yourself from that condition.
Mm-hmm. There are a few marriages that can hobble along for years when a masochist marries a sadist. And sometimes he punishes her by refusing to beat her.
In these questions, one gets nowhere with generalities. It is only in the unique set of factors of two particular people and how they are living out the fact that they are Christ's redeemed man and woman and husband and wife. I'm sorry, I think you were first.
I thought that Lewis, I like the way he talked about this eros, this love. It cannot maintain its level. We thought it's not of dying, a matter of dying, but it says, can we be in this selfless liberation for a lifetime? Hardly for a week. But then, and I think so many people go into marriage with the expectation that it will maintain this level, and when it doesn't, they think love is dead. But he says that these lapses will not destroy a marriage between two decent and sensible people. And the marriage that will be destroyed are the ones who have idolized Eros, which we talked about before. But then, there is a program like taking the rough along with the smooth and so on and so forth. You go through these periods in the, maybe it never will reach this high that it once had, but it reaches a very satisfactory thing that we can live with. It says all good Christian lovers know that this program, modest as it sounds, this business of taking the rough with the smooth and so on, will not be carried out except by humility, charity, and divine grace. Yet it is indeed the whole Christian life seen from one particular angle.
We would never dare to make marriage vows if we only knew we had our own resources to count on. And we are so ill-served with all the tosh that comes at us through the box and the magazines about love and this sort of high point business.
It's possible, though, that human conduct is very rarely affected by all that advice that comes in magazines and, to some extent, most of it that comes in sermons. That is to say, human life is such that all the words that are of wisdom that are thrown upon us possibly have very little effect. I remember a Hemingway story called Hills Like Great White Elephants, one of the best stories that he wrote, where a marriage was on the edge of deterioration, possibly because one partner may have been having a bit of insanity. And he is such a nice English gentleman, And he talks to her so nicely. What do you want to do, dear? Do you or do you not want an abortion? Do you or not want to live in Paris or New York? You're the end of the story. She says, will you please, please, please be quiet? So words of wisdom have been poured upon us for centuries, and I have the feeling they have relatively little effect on husbands and wives, because think of the psychologists and preachers who have such miserable marriages. And so forth. You and I are an exception.
But there has been a great devaluation of words and so much tosh, but there are redeemed and redeeming words, and we hear them in the absolution. Your sins are forgiven you. And when Christ says that, that's the fact. That's how it is. We are forgiven, accepted, taken on, embraced, incorporated, quickened, enlivened, carried forward by Him within that forgiveness. As also when the vows are made, and husband and wife, and what God has joined together, let no man put asunder. That is bedrock fact. And to live in the confidence of that bedrock fact enables you to have great freedom in your marriage. Then you're free to have a good old fight now and then, because you're not having to prove that you're husband and wife anymore. You know that to be the case. That is so. And so it's when you're having to be proving or keeping the score and it isn't adding up to as much as it once did that you get into a bind. And the ongoingness always of love, living through its fluctuations, but always, always more, always open to the more, the better, and the tomorrow, and not prescriptively reaching back to some sort of golden age in the marriage, as people are apt to do, you know, 5 or 10 years down the line. They say, well, my heart hasn't been fluttering lately the way it did on the honeymoon. Well, it would be a great pity if it did. You ought to be a whole lot further on in loving one another than having all those butterfly businesses. I mean, that was great, but you don't go on having honeymoons all the time. You have lived. They two shall be one flesh, and that living sharedness of life allows you to look back at your honeymoon and say, we thought we loved each other then. Oh, how simple. Look where we are now. And that we don't use spurious prescriptive criteria like that. You know, when you've been married 50, 60 years, and the old man sort of nods by the fire, and she says something, and he grunts, and you know, that's him and his grunt, and we understand each other. There's not much pitter-patter about that in the old ticker, but there is a deep having lived together. And the ways of living together are unique for each marriage. I mean, the marriage manuals, pitch them away, make your own marriage. There's only going to be one like that. And some marriages, you know, to the outsiders look like a dogfight. But they're enjoying it. They wouldn't be without it. Life would be empty. There's one very moving story my father told of a man who had been really a pretty beastly husband. And then he was coming to die, And his wife, who had suffered much from him, was weeping and said to the pastor, "I wouldn't want to lose him, bad as he is." And for that kind of commitment, we are disenabled if we play at it in an as-if, that there is in fornication and in adultery, for they are lies, and to live in untruth is always destructive. All of this trial marriage business that goes on nowadays and so on. To live as if you were husband and wife, to act toward one another, to act as if you were giving yourself completely to somebody else. And that is not true. That is damaging. But to live this eros through to its in its fullness, that we would bring to our marriages all that we possibly can, our gift of ourselves into the marriage, not second or 20 hand, but given in the whole of ourselves, in a statement then of vows which are lived true. The truth or the falsehoods in our living, and fornication and adultery are a great lie. For there we are still regarding somebody as interchangeable. And that is not marriage-sized love. And then in the spouse, there is that particular set of gifts that's there in the bounty of the first article, but each of them needing to be redeemed so that it can be gift and not brought into bondage of demand. And we spoke yesterday, if some wives really must share everything with their husbands, and so for the first year or two they go along to the ball game with him and pretend that they're enjoying it too. And then after a while their love matures to the point where she can say, "Your baseball is a frightful bore. I think I'm going to go and see Cousin Jane this afternoon instead." And he harumps and goes off to the ball game and enjoys it, and she has good time with her friend. We may not expect the idealized eros expects the spouse to be paragon of all gifts and virtues. If we know ourselves to be sinners redeemed, we are freed from making those kind of demands. And so we find lacks in one another, and things that irritate and hurt. But we mayn't let it become sort of bogged down, immobilized. Living is always moving. And the death comes with that immobility and the kind of refusals that happen there.
thinking about just love itself, I think it has to come from God because it's so absolutely crazy. It's the one force in all the world that works. It's there in intimacy of two people.
It's there with many people, and it never runs out no matter how you give and give and give and give. It's still yours, and you've given it all away, but you still have it. And I think there's nothing else I can think of that you still have and still have given to everything. So therefore, I think it must be God's will. It's just so wild and unbelievable.
Right, right. Life, life is the more and the more and the onward, and he's still got a whole lot more up his sleeve. But he's bringing us on our way with what he shares of his love and
you
his life.
One child or 15, you still have the same amount of love. It's never diminished. Maybe you don't have the finances, but you got the love.
Right, bravo. Thank you, Gertrude. There goes the bell.